This is KGOU's Oklahoma Voices. I'm Kate Carlton Greer, joined by M. Scott Carter and Clifton Adcock of Oklahoma Watch. Welcome.
Thanks.
For the past few months, KGOU and Oklahoma Watch have been teaming up to present this series called Prisoners of Debt. We've looked into several ways an offender can end up being charged thousands of dollars after incarceration. Today, we'll discuss the debt former prisoners face after leaving incarceration and how the state's crime-funded court system has evolved over the past two decades. Later this half hour, we'll look at the effect of the increased costs for criminals and talk about some nonprofits providing assistance for offenders. Clifton, when offenders are charged with a crime, that person's bill, in essence, starts climbing?
That's right. From the second they're arrested, usually that's when the bill starts. Now, they're not actually billed until they're found guilty. But throughout the process, and a lot of times with filings for requesting jury trials and things like that, that just keeps adding on to the bill. And then once they're found guilty, they're presented with this bill, often running thousands or tens of thousands of dollars.
And tell me about, you talked about the court filing fees, if there needs to be a jury. There are also jail per diem rates?
That's right. Often offenders can be charged $40, $47 per day that they stay in jail. Now, once they're found guilty, the bill then is taken over by the Department of Corrections. But for that time leading up to the trial that they sit in jail, they're charged up to around $47 per day.
And Scott, tell me about that. It sounds like $40 a day. How harmless can that be?
Well, if you're in jail for any length of time, that number adds up really quickly. We actually got a copy of a bill the other day. Cliff and I had been trying to track one down. I got a copy of the bill sent by the Oklahoma County Sheriff to an offender who had been in jail for more than 280 days. And the per diem alone was more than $11,000. So the charges stack up really, really quickly.
Because that per diem, it's important to point out, that's separate than any court costs, fines, or fees that are assessed.
Right, right. That's on top of all the other costs. And, you know, if there's a fine for whatever violation you committed, and then the court fees and all the other stuff, there's also this per diem rate that allows jails to try to recover their cost. And it can go really big very quickly.
Now, back to the court costs. Tell me about some of the things offenders are charged with.
Usually they're charged a cleat fee, which
and
is cleat being a Council on Law Enforcement Education and Training. That runs around $9, $9 to $11. They can be charged the $25 court information system revolving fund fee, and they can get charged things like that more than once. So for each count you face, each offense that you face and are found guilty of, that gets tacked on to each one of those. So say you're facing two felony charges, you'll get two $25 Oklahoma court information system revolving fund fees. They run the gamut from $5 fee for the Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs for any marijuana or paraphernalia possession fee, to $11 for courthouse security, $35 to file a bond to bond out of jail, and $5 for fingerprinting. There's a large number of fees associated with that.
I think what's interesting about that is people don't understand those things are all built into the per count charge. If you're charged with two counts of DUI, for example, the total charge is going to be between $400 and $700. The actual fine, the designed to, you know, supposed to deter the bad behavior, may be only $100. But all the other fees, as Cliff was talking about, all these other fees are stacked on top of that. We saw one case where a misdemeanor transporting an open container, the total charge for that count is $366. Of that, only $10 is the fine. The rest are all these other charges.
We spoke with the state Supreme Court Vice Chief Justice Douglas Combs, and he mentioned how things are getting worse. We're now tacking on more fines and fees, and they don't all just stay with the court. Like you guys were saying, some go to state agencies. Back in 2014, roughly a third of the money that the courts collected went elsewhere. Tell me about what caused this.
If you really want to look at when all this started, you have to go back to the 1990s after the passage of State Question 640.
Tell me about that.
State Question 640 was in response to a fight over an education bill that included a tax increase. And they tried to repeal the education bill and couldn't do it. So the next thing that happened was a group of people got together. They were led by an Oklahoma City stockbroker who pushed back against the legislature being able to raise taxes. And what the bill said and what became a part of the Constitution was that the legislature had to have a supermajority, a three-fourths vote in each house to raise taxes. And then the bill couldn't have what is known as an emergency clause, which would allow the tax to go into effect immediately. It had to have a 90-day window before the tax could go into effect. The other way, if the legislature wanted to do it without the three-fourths majority in each house, was they would submit it to a vote of the people. Once that passed, every lawmaker at the Capitol kind of realized we're never going to see another tax increase in Oklahoma, so they went to Plan B, which was an increase in fines and fees, just across the board, everything. And you saw that as early as 2000, just a few years later. This thing, it began to really grow, and that's where fines and fees have increased since then, is because there's not an easy way for the legislature to increase taxes.
We kind of looked at the history of the fee schedules. I know, Cliff, you looked at a lot of that. Tell me about what you found just of the increase starting in 1992 with that state question passage.
Right. In 1992, just prior to this state question being passed, according to the court filing fee schedule, basically a list of all the fees they had, you saw 23 fees that could be tacked on to a criminal case. This year, in the 2015, you see 63 of them. So it has grown pretty substantially since that time, the number of fees. And not all of those are to the court. A lot of them go to executive-level agencies like the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation or the Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics.
We also go to agencies other than public safety agencies. The court did a report. State Supreme Court did a report. It documented all these fines and fees. And it said that they collected from 2007 to 2014 more than $1 billion. And of that, about $777 million went to the court system. And the remaining $400 million went to these other agencies.
So, again, we're looking about a third of the amount that the court collects goes elsewhere.
That's correct.
And you see a lot of it, too, funding non-law enforcement, non-criminal justice agencies. Like there's trauma care fund fees. Now, that funds the state's uncompensated care system, which basically means if you go into a hospital for care and you can't pay, they pull money out of that, and they use that to pull down federal dollars for hospitals. And there are several instances, several crimes where you get a $100 or $200 fee for the trauma care fund tacked onto your bill. So it funds a lot more than the criminal justice system.
I want to talk real quickly before we take a break about the mentality of the lawmakers when they drafted this. What went into their thinking?
Well, I think part of that is a tough on crime attitude. You saw this early in the 90s and in the mid 90s when they passed the three strikes and you're out legislation and what was originally known as truth in sentencing. And that has evolved to a tough on crime persona there, that the legislature, it's very easy to sell an increase in a fee if you say, well, the people convicted of this crime are going to have to pay it. Everybody goes, okay, well, they won't have to pay it if they don't get in trouble. But it's gotten so out of proportion that attitude has led to a system that we've shifted so much funding on the backs of people who are incarcerated that it's in danger of collapse.
It is interesting how, I mean, we call this a crime-funded system, essentially, and we're relying on these people that are least likely or least able to pay to fund the courts, to fund the district attorneys. They're all contingent on these fines and fees.
That's correct. It's, you have people who are, in many cases, almost end up indigent. They qualify for government assistance. They qualify for TANF benefits and food stamps and things like that. And part of that money that they're getting from the state and the feds is going right back in a circle to pay the $50 a month fines and fees they owe some district court.
That's M. Scott Carter, and he's sitting with Clifton Adcock, both reporters for Oklahoma Watch. And we're talking about the fees assessed against criminals in Oklahoma. We'll have more about the effect of the high cost of incarceration on individuals coming up after a short break. I'm Kate Carlton Greer, and you're listening to KGOU.
You're listening to a special edition of Oklahoma Voices, representing a joint investigative news venture between KGOU and Oklahoma Watch reporters. Individual reports in the Prisoners of Debt series can be found on our website, kgou.org. The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the partnering organizations KGOU, Oklahoma Watch, or KGOU's licensee, the University of Oklahoma.
You are listening to a special edition of Oklahoma Voices. I'm Kate Carlton Greer. In this half hour, I'm talking with Oklahoma Watch reporters M. Scott Carter and Clifton Adcock about a collaborative investigation led by Oklahoma Watch, which explores the costs of incarceration that offenders incur through the state's legal system. It's a series called Prisoners of Debt. In the previous segment, we discussed the roots of Oklahoma's crime-funded court system and the reasons for the rising fees and fines that offenders have faced over the past two decades. Cliff, we spent a lot of time at the prisoner reentry program called Exodus House in Oklahoma City, where Robin Wirtz works. Tell me a bit about Robin's story.
Sure. Robin, she had gotten in trouble for drug trafficking, both in California and Oklahoma. She spent some time in prison in California, but then was extradited back to Oklahoma, and that's when the real bills kicked in.
I remember thinking I might as well call my friends in California and have them bring me some dope, and I would start selling dope again.
She had, I believe, more than $25,000 in debt. Incurred from her fines and fees and court costs. She went to Exodus House and eventually started to work there and help other inmates transition back into society.
And Scott, what exactly is Exodus House? How does it work?
Exodus House is you have to apply, and they have a facility in Oklahoma City and a facility in Tulsa, and it provides housing and counseling. Lots of drug and alcohol counseling, and it provides a chance for ex-offenders to get a job and get back on their feet so they can make a really good transition back into the workforce and back into kind of a normal life. They reduce the rent really, really low. They provide furniture, and they provide lots of counseling for these guys so they get a chance to start over. One of the things that it does is because the rent's so low and because it's subsidized and they have some transportation that they can get to and from work, they can help these people get jobs and save money to start paying some of these fines and fees back. It's very successful. I know in Tulsa, they have a waiting list of 250 applicants, and the story's similar in Oklahoma City. They don't work with sex offenders and they don't work with violent offenders. They all work with primarily nonviolent offenders. And most of them have some type of drug and alcohol addiction that they're really fighting and working on. And I think the counseling component is often overlooked because they really put these people through their paces in getting drug and alcohol counseling.
And Exodus House, just to kind of paint a picture, it's a small little apartment complex in Oklahoma City. It's not this rehabilitation center that you would traditionally think of. It's a small place, and everyone seems very close-knit. There are about 15 to 20 participants. I think in 2014, the Exodus House in Oklahoma City served 40 ex-offenders and helped them get back on their feet.
That's correct. The Tulsa operates pretty similar the same way. They're funded. One of their big funders is the United Methodist Foundation, their criminal justice and mercy ministries. They have kind of stepped into the breach on some of this to help these people transition back. And it's one of the more successful programs out there.
It's a small group of nonprofits that are able to do this. You have Exodus House, and then you have TEAM, which is the Employment and Education Ministry, also in Oklahoma City. And they provide work assistance. They help offenders find jobs. And they actually start 6 months prior to a release most times. And so you kind of get that transition. There's also a place in Tulsa called the Reentry One Stop.
That's correct.
Cliff, can you talk about, is there a gap? Is there a need for more of these places?
Well, I'm sure a lot of folks coming out of prison would say, yes, there is. A lot of times, you know, the ones who get in there, get into programs like that are lucky because many times they're released out onto the street if they don't have any probation as part of their judgment and sentence. They turn them loose on the street. And it's basically, here's $50 and a bus ticket. Good luck.
Literally,
that's what they get. So the ones who do get into those programs are lucky. Like Scott said, they provide counseling. They provide addiction services. They help you get a job. Otherwise, you're basically on your own with whatever reentry program the Department of Corrections has. You know, they have a few things where they say, okay, you have to visit this county to get your debts in order. You have to go here as part of your probation if you're on probation. But a lot of times, yeah, offenders don't have the things that like Exodus House or TEAM provides.
You have this list of stuff you got to get done, you know? I got to do this and this and this. If you get out of prison and you ain't got nobody there, then what do? You go back to selling drugs. Is what you do.
Robin says herself that she just didn't even know where to start. It's just overwhelming.
She told me she was one day away from going back and selling drugs because the fines and fees were so high. And had she not gotten that job, that she would have contacted her old suppliers and went right back to the game again. So the work that these groups are doing, like TEAM, like Exodus House, they give these people a thread to hang on to. And they also, one thing we really haven't discussed, they also, transportation is a huge deal. If you're an ex-felon and you've lost your driver's license and you can't drive legally, Exodus House and TEAM, they help with issues like that. And that's a big deal because those people, they get that job and they start making money, and then slowly the debt hopefully will begin to fall away, or they gradually get their driver's license back and they start working themselves back into just a sense of normalcy. Cliff did a lot of research on that, and he kind of focused, at least I know one story, on dealing with the driver's license issue.
That's right. It's interesting. Right around the same time that State Question 640 was passed, in 1993, there was a court ruling, and I believe it was a civil appeals court ruling, but it later went to the Supreme Court, a separate but similar case, where the court said that the Department of Public Safety can't charge a reinstatement fee. If you've had your driver's license revoked or suspended, they can't charge a reinstatement fee for every single suspension or revocation you've had on your license. They can only charge one. So the next year you see lawmakers go in there and change the law, and they said, okay, you can only have one reinstatement fee, and we're going to lower it from $100 to $25. However, we're going to also charge a $75 processing fee for each one of those. So it essentially renamed the fee, and later on they tacked on again a trauma care fee of $200 for if you've had it suspended because of DUI or drugs. So all these little things start adding up, and it can range hundreds to even thousands of dollars that you have to pay in order to get your driver's license back. I'm speaking with one guy who he's actually going to end up having to pay more than $4,000 because he's been ordered to put an ignition interlock device, basically a breathalyzer, in order to start the vehicle up. on his vehicle as part of his reinstatement. And now the monthly charges end up adding up to more than $4,000 that in the long run he's going to have to pay to get his license back. And that's important because how do you get to work if you don't have any public transportation, especially in rural areas or areas where the buses – or if you work a job where the buses don't run at night, then, yeah, good luck getting there.
It's a tough situation. Scott, you were telling me you visited Team in Oklahoma City, and there was a man that was getting his driver's license that day.
Yeah, that's correct. They were actually having a party for him because it's such a big moment in the lives of some of these ex-offenders is when they've paid, done the process, paid the bill, and they get that driver's license back. And they were the first time I went over there, the staff was getting ready to take this guy to DPS. They were paying his final check for him to get his license back. And he was bouncing off the wall because it was such a big moment. You know, you think about that when you're 16, but you don't think about how important it is if you've got two kids you're now trying to take care of or a life you're trying to rebuild, how important that driver's license is.
It's really a symbol for them of true freedom because they come out and they're still, we say, basically incarcerated by the debt that they owe. It's very constricting for them. And then when they're finally able to get this driver's license, it frees them up to be at work on time.
Well, and not only that, but you have a lot of these guys that they find the job when they get out because there are employers. I was really surprised to find a number of employers that were willing to work with ex-offenders. And there are several in Oklahoma City that do that. But you still have to be able to get to work. So a lot of these guys are still at risk because they're driving illegally. And if you get pulled over and stopped and they see that you're an ex-offender, there's no pay the fine and go on to work. You're going to go right back to jail. And so getting that driver's license and being legal again is a huge step in rebuilding their lives.
Yeah, I think a lot of them see it as a symbol of their independence. As you don't have to rely on your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your mom to drive you to work or, you know, try to work your schedule around the bus system. You can go where you want to, when you want to. And I think for a lot of them who have been incarcerated for several years, that's a big deal.
I would agree with you. I want to talk just briefly about going back to the importance of these nonprofits just as far as case management, because you talked to Robin Wirtz, who says it's just overwhelming for these people. And if you don't have someone walking beside you, the chances of you just going back to committing a crime again, like Robin said she was about to do, that goes up much higher. Can we just talk about the recidivism rate in Oklahoma right now? We're sitting at about 22.3%. And the effect of these nonprofits, their recidivism rates are generally below 5%. So it shows that people who have help and who have access to say, look, if you just show up to this county courthouse and we're going to have you pay $20 a month here, that's a big obstacle that a lot of times it's just too much for them to swallow when they're first released.
Well, I know a team in Exodus House, both, they can also plug into a network of attorneys who have pledged to help. And so they can go in and get a Rule 8 hearing and get the judges to reduce some of the cost or get them on a payment plan that they can manage. And sometimes they go in and fight some of those. On occasion or two, they actually get some of that debt removed. They have to push back pretty hard, and sometimes it takes a while, but it can happen. But if you don't have that network when you get out, then you're just stuck with this huge amount of debt and a very thin opportunity to try to rebuild your life.
We're at 116% capacity in our prisons. And throughout this series of reporting, we've talked to a handful of people that say, you know, the big line right now is we're one lawsuit away from federal intervention. Looking at the future of the criminal justice system, how it's funded, what does the future look like?
Well, it's hard to tell. But at some point, you know, something's got to give. You can't put debt on people who most in a lot of cases aren't going to be able to pay or choose not to pay and then expect to fund a steadily fund a system on that, the entire, you know, a good portion of the criminal justice system on that. A DOC, you know, law enforcement, they're all, you know, facing funding issues. So as well as the courts, you know, you see the level of state support for the courts going down over the years as a proportion of the state budget or the proportion of the court's budget. So they're relying more and more on these fees and stepping up collection efforts. But the problem is, early on when they started doing that, they got all the low-hanging fruit and the easy collections. Now it's sort of plateaued out, so they're not expecting it to rise and rise unless you bring more people into the criminal justice system who can pay, which that in itself presents a problem.
Well, and there's some danger there too, because then you start – then you start end up being seeing incarceration and seeing criminal penalties for things that, well, like in Oklahoma where you see it for small drug charges that really should just be a fine and done, or some type of treatment and done. Oklahomans have had kind of a love-hate relationship with taxes for years. I remember a former state treasurer who once said, Scott Meacham, who once said, the gap between what Oklahomans expect from their government, their state government, and what they're willing to pay for is larger than the Grand Canyon. And there's a lot of truth to that, because taxes are so demonized, but the court system and the criminal justice system and all those components are a part of state government, and they have to be funded with public dollars. The primary funding has to be public dollars. It can't be, you cannot completely fund DPS or the Department of Corrections off fines and fees that are assessed to offenders. It just, there's not enough money there, and they don't have that section of the audience doesn't have the financial wherewithal to pay.
I think a good example of that too is the Oklahoma County Jail, where the feds threatened to step in. You have the reality that, hey, the feds are going to take over if we don't fix up this jail, build a new jail. But then you have the political reality of, yeah, but then we have to pass a tax increase, and that, good luck with that. You know,
it's hard to do right now.
Right.
That's Clifton Adcock and M. Scott Carter with Oklahoma Watch, and you've been listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. We've been talking today about the fines and fees assessed against criminals to fund the court system in Oklahoma. You can find more about the series Prisoners of Debt online at kgou.org and oklahomawatch.org. You can also connect with us via Twitter individually at KGOU News and at Oklahoma Watch. For KGOU, I'm Kate Carlton Greer.